It's awesome. My name is Sable, and I am an alcoholic. By the grace of God, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you people, I have not found it necessary to have a drink or a drug since May 19th,
1980.
For that, I am eternally grateful. Yes. I want to thank the committee for asking me, and thanking God for realizing that I got a modicum of humility and that my head would not get too swelled by being here, because I have an ego that is such that I need you people to let me know that I'm okay. You are my heroin and you are my booze, and that's what I always wanted, was to know that I was okay. Just to tell you a little bit in a second about the unmanageability of my life. It was a few years ago, and I remembered this. I was standing in Times Square, and for people who don't know what Times Square is, it's the porno district, the hooker district, the sleazy district of any town. And I was standing there on the corner, waiting for John to come by, because I needed to turn a trick. And this John comes by, and I pick him up. He looks like a good trick. He turns out to be a vice cop. So he locks me up, and I stay in jail a few days. They take you to court, and then they let you out again. I went back to that same corner in Times Square because, as John said, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. And I see this John, and he looks like a good trick, and I pick him up, and it's the same vice cop. Right? Yes. My life was unmanageable. You know, when your deviant life gets messed up, you're in deep trouble. I want to talk just a little bit at the beginning about my accomplishments in AA before I go on to tell you my story, because sometimes it always gets so lost when we get into the drunk log and tell about what happened and what it was like. You know, we are people who find it so easy to put ourselves down. We must, and I must, look at the things that I have accomplished. And I want you to know that not for a moment do I believe that I could have done this without you, without the steps of AA, and without God. I really don't. First of all, I learned to be a friend. It is a gift. I learned how to work. You know, I drank and drugged for 21 years, and the last 12 of which I was incapable of doing anything. So I learned to work. I got fired 3 times in sobriety, and 1 time by 2 drunks. I remember when I got my first paycheck, I Xeroxed it and brought it to a meeting. I was like a little kid. I learned how to balance a checkbook. I learned how to get insurance for an apartment. You know, when you start getting the material things, then you have to worry about people like me stealing them. I learned how to show up. I learned how to make commitments. I learned how to be intimate, and I heard a wonderful definition of intimacy. You know, we all talk about our problems with intimacy, and we don't know what the hell it is. The definition really touched me. It was being ourselves in front of someone else. And if you can't learn it anywhere, you can learn it here. I learned how to be a sponsor. I have 2 wonderful sponsors here. They're babies or pigeons, wherever you are. Elaine, who's my longest and dearest sponsor for 7.5 years, she trains me. And David, who we've been together a few years, and it's really a gift, the joy that they give me. I learned to let go of some of my selfishness and self-centeredness. You know, the Big Book talks about that being the root of our troubles. It never says that alcohol is the root of our troubles. That selfishness and self-centeredness, and I'm learning to let go of that. I learned to be of service. And that's how I perfect and enlarge my spiritual life. I learned how to give, you know, and I learned how to receive. I learned how to keep a job for a while, too, getting back to that. When I was in jail for the last time and I was sentenced to 1 year, I worked in the staff dining room. And when I came out and eventually got to AA, I became a chef. So I always say that it's the city jail, and I don't know if you people here would know it, but I say that I'm a graduate of the Rikers Island Culinary School. It doesn't go on my resume, but I have full room and board on tuition and clothes. But I can't, you know, sometimes you don't know what's going to happen when we're doing something. So I learned how to do that, and I've been doing it for a long time. And then I decided to change careers. And this May, I graduated from graduate school, and I got a master's in social work. The most, yeah. Yeah. The most wonderful thing about the graduation was that I had two rows of AA friends and my brother and sister-in-law, who are both in the program, sitting there and telling me they wanted to come to graduation. Do you know what that feels like for somebody who, when I came into the program, I had no friends, no one invited me anywhere, and if they did, they'd never invite me back again, and I stood in the corner with the whiners to tell me they wanted to be there with me. And the next most amazing thing to me is that I am a psychotherapist. I am starting private practice. Now you say, well, you graduated from social work school. That's fine. But I have to tell you that I have been in mental hospitals. I don't know if you know about Bellevue. Okay, I am an alumni of Bellevue. I was in a wheelchair strapped down. I wound up in the LA County Psychiatric Ward strapped down in many other hospitals. So to tell you that this program works, I couldn't even put it into words how much it works. Someone asked me, how does it work? It works good. Real good. Yeah. And I like to tell stories because they help me get a message, and I like to pass them on, and how this whole change came, you know? And just the last thing, as I have a relationship with God, because God gets me through everything. Even in the depths of despair, I always have hope because your people taught me about a higher power. And if you're frightened of God, for the newcomers, give it a shot, you know? If I told you I had the greatest drug in the world or the greatest drink in the world and it'd get in no trouble and it was free and it'd make you feel good to be lined up. So give it a shot. Anyway. It was in Nazi Germany, and there was this little girl in school, a little Jewish girl, and they were having show and tell. So the little Jewish girl raises her hand, and the Nazi teacher says, little Jew girl, what do you have to tell the class? And the little Jewish girl says, my cat just had kittens, and they're all Nazis. Oh, now the teacher's mind is going and thinking, wow, this is wonderful propaganda. A Jew with Nazi kittens? I got to call Heinrich Himmler and have him come down here and make films, and I'm going to get promoted. So he calls Himmler and he tells Himmler about the story, and Himmler says, okay, I'm going to be in your neighborhood in a while, and when I do, I'll stop by the school. So some time passes, and Himmler comes to school. The teacher says, little Jew girl, tell Himmler about your cat. And the little Jewish girl stands up, and she said, my cat had kittens, and they're all social democrats. And the teacher is appalled, and Himmler's getting upset. And the teacher says, I thought they were Nazis. And she said, they were, until their eyes were open. You opened my eyes to a life that I never could have imagined. Yes. And that I was able to have the spiritual experience that they talk about in the 12th step. It says, after we work all the steps, we get it. And it tells us that it's a personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism. And that I had a profound reaction to life. I had an alteration in my reaction to life. I don't react the same way. Life goes on the same way. When I put my money in the soda machine and the soda doesn't come down, I don't try to kick the crap out of it anymore. And it's like that in the rest of my life. I mean, I have major slips now and again, but I have had that change. In the big book, it says, and I talk a lot of big book, I'm trying to get a little less presumptuous so I don't quote the pages, but my ego is such that I get off on it. You will need to bear with me. I was told that my big book was my owner's manual, and that when I'm broken, I go there and I can find everything to fix me. If you haven't picked it up, give it a shot. Even if you need to put it in the bathroom and just read a page or a sentence or a paragraph at a time. It tells us that the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind and not his body. And that's what it was. My mind was nuts. That's the insanity that they talk about in the second step. My mind was nuts. You know, in the doctor's opinion, Dr. Sokol says that when the alcoholic drinks because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And after a while, even though we know it's not good, we can't stop. And then what happens is we can't tell the true from the false. That we think our alcoholic way of life is normal. And that's what happened to me. And there's a wonderful story that I love about the keen alcoholic mind. God, if yours is anything like mine, it's almost impossible. Sometimes I try to run away from myself. Anyway, so there's this alcoholic, and he's going up on a trip, and he's in a small town. He's dressed up in a three-piece suit because it's a business trip. He's driving along, and he gets a flat tire. Oh, my God. He's okay. Pulls the car over. He opens the trunk to get the jack, and there's no jack. Now the committee goes to work. He says, my God, this is a small town. I'm a city slicker. The gas station's 5 miles back. I don't even know if they're going to lend me the jack. He starts walking, and he says, I don't know. I'm all decked out. This is a small town. If that gas station attendant lends me the jack, he's probably going to charge me $10. And he's walking a little more and walking a little more. He says, the small town people, they hate city slickers, and if he lends me the jack, he's probably going to charge me $25. And now it starts to rain, and the committee is really going. They're filibustering up there, and he's walking, and he says, now if this gas station attendant lends this city slicker the jack, he's going to charge me $50. So he finally gets to the gas station. He opens up the door. The attendant opens up the door, and the alcoholic says to him, keep the fucking jack. You know, I don't know about you, but I have fights with people and they don't even know they're involved. I always like when I'm getting fired for a job and I haven't even gotten an interview yet. So what I do when I start to do that projection is a tool that I use is I say, fuck the jack, and I get back into the mirror, because in the mirror it's always perfect. But it's that projection. So I was told when I came to AA that the steps would change my thinking, and that's what I needed to do. What I found out after being in AA for a while was that it was the solutions to my problems that got me in trouble. And it was not my problems. Even as a kid, I acted out. I'm not going into any family stuff, but I will tell you that I came from a kind and loving family who understood nothing about parenting, did not know how to talk about their emotions, and didn't know how to cope. And that's why I had no skills when I went out in the world. The first of my tales that I will tell you, and I usually tell the same ones because it's the ones that are most painful for me, and I do something that they talk about in psychology. It's called isolation of affect, and that is, I tell you the story, but I can defend myself against my feelings because it is so painful. But I have to tell you that they really, really upset me. I wanted to move to California. I had no money. The solution to my problem was I sold all the furniture and antiques out of my friend's parents' house. I never once thought it was wrong. I took that money, I came back to the city, I bought drugs because I needed more money. Within a 10-day period, I got arrested, and it led to 2 felony convictions. Now, never one for not having any money. I would like to say, though, that when I first came to AA, I had 2 felony convictions and 2 college degrees. Now, I have 3 college degrees and 2 felony convictions. Not to get too taken with myself, I have to remember what Father Martin says, that thermometers have degrees, and you know where some of them go. So this is the kinds of things that happen to me. Never anything minimal. I am an extremist. I was living in Puerto Rico when I got pregnant. Forgive me, Elaine, she hates when I tell this story, but this is how powerful this disease is. It is about life and death. And I got pregnant, and my girlfriend would go to the hotels and turn tricks so that we could get the money to fly to St. Thomas and get an abortion because you couldn't get it in Puerto Rico. And she did this a few times, and every time she brought the money home, I would drink 151 proof rum and shoot up dope. And finally she said, I'm not doing this anymore. And I had a homemade abortion with a crochet hook and a water pick, and I did not think there was anything wrong with it. Also, I want to say to the people whose physical bottom is not as insane as mine, to please remember that it's a threefold disease. And in the big book, it tells us that to be gravely affected, you don't have to drink as much or as long as this. and that in the 12 and 12 they raise the battle. So if you're like me, you always focus on the physical and you forget about the mental and the spiritual. But I don't believe that anyone came here because they had a high mental or spiritual bottom. I mean, could you just imagine saying, you know, I was at a party last night, I had a couple of drinks, I was so rude to the hostess, I think I'll go to AA. Doesn't work that way. We have that incomprehensible demoralization, that self-loathing, you know, and you can come here and get rid of it. I was in California, and I was in L.A., and I lived in L.A. from time to time until the courts would keep sending me back to New York every time I got busted. And it was in L.A. that I really wanted to come to San Francisco. It's been 20 years that I wanted to come to San Francisco, except I never took any action. I never got sober enough. I never got a ride from L.A. to San Francisco. And I never got here, and because of you, I'm here, so I appreciate that. Anyway. I'm in L.A., and I've gone out to have some drinks with a friend of mine and an ex-girlfriend of hers. When we come home, we're sitting in our house, and the ex-girlfriend is very drunk and very crazy and stabs me, and stabs my friend with a chef's knife. Now, this was my reaction. I had a brand-new, beautiful beige gabardine blazer that I had gotten with a hot credit card in New York. And I said to the woman who just tried to kill me, you've ruined my blazer. Talk about externals. But it hasn't changed. I have my spiffy New York Saturday night outfit on. It's hot as hell with the silk, but it looks good. You know, it doesn't change, but now I understand myself. So anyway, I take the jacket off and I tell her, you have to clean this jacket and fix it for me. In the meantime, my friend calls the police. They come and they take her away and they take us away to be stitched up. And they say, don't worry, she's never coming out. A few days later, she's standing at the back door. She's holding up a prescription for Tylenols. She says, I have my money. I said, come on in. It was as if she never tried to hurt me. She's going to have something that was going to take me outside of me. So I gave her the money for the prescription. She left the bottle of scotch. While she was gone, my friend and I said, look, we better kill her because she could hurt us again. So when she comes back, we give her a lot of pills and a lot of scotch. Nothing happens. We give her more pills and more scotch, and nothing happens. Now, I had a major problem, and I need a solution. So the alcoholic mind goes to work, and I had remembered, as a heroin addict, they always said to you, do not shoot up those air bubbles. So I got my syringe, and I start to shoot up the air bubbles. Nothing happened. When I came to AA, I found out I would need 200 to 300 syringe bowls, and if you're anything like this alcoholic, you have no patience. So I said to my friend, I'm going to the liquor store. That's what I did when I couldn't cope with feelings, frustrations, happiness, sadness. It didn't matter. I went to the liquor store. And it was in that story that I remembered when I came to AA and I read Bill Wilson's story. I said, how am I going to identify with this guy? Oh, my God. And he talks about the stock market crash. And he says, I've heard him on tape and I can hear his smugness. He said, oh, yes, stock market crash in 1929. The stockbroker's jumping out windows. He said, not me, he said. I went back to the bar. And that's where the identification comes in. Not with the external stuff, but what did we do? So anyway, what happened was when I went to the liquor store, someone else came to the house and they killed her. When I came home, the dead body was outside. Now, I want you I can't believe it myself that I could have been this person. I came home and I tripped over the dead body. And my first thoughts were, oh shit, a manslaughter charge. Again into the selfishness and self-centeredness, worrying about the inconveniences. That's it. That's where I was, and that's who I was, and it's frightening, and it's sad, and it's painful for me. So I took the body, and I put some pills in the pocket, and I dragged it down the hills and put it in the bushes. And that is where this disease took me. The cops said, don't worry, just another dead junkie, and I didn't think about it until I came to AA.
It's painful. I want to go kind of quickly because I like to talk a little bit about how I got sober. Anyway, I wound up living in an abandoned building. And we had to put wires up to keep the rats out, sleeping on a mattress. I could no longer steal my driver's checks, go to your house and steal turn tricks, sell drugs. I couldn't do anything. I was drinking pints of wine out of a brown paper bag. And I want to tell you that I started out drinking top shelf alcohol at the Plaza and the Waldorf. So if you think that you haven't gotten there long enough, it can happen to you. Anyway, this particular day, the drug dealer came to my house. This is when I needed to get out of the house. I shot some pharmaceutical heroin, I took some Valium, I smoked some pot, and I drank a pint of wine. The drugs did not affect me, but I was very, very drunk. I went outside, I pickpocketed an 87-year-old lady. I don't know why I did that. Those were not the kinds of crimes I did, not because I had any morals, but because I was scared. Anyway, it was in Times Square on a sunny Sunday afternoon with lots of plainclothes cops, and they grabbed me from behind. And having been arrested and convicted 13 times that I remember, I knew that feeling, and it was, thank God. My life was so unmanageable out there, I couldn't take care of myself. And they locked me up, and I was facing the judge, and I was facing 7.5 to 15 years for robbing an 87-year-old lady because I had 2 prior felony convictions. But thank God, God intervened. They pre-bargained and gave me 1 year. And the same thing happened behind bars. I made potato wine. I got put into solitary for sniffing glue. I had lots of sets of syringes, so when people brought drugs in, I could get high. It didn't change because I didn't change. The warden sent me in a work release the day before my parole. I went in the work release. I called a friend. I went to visit her, and I drank and I drugged because I was powerless, and I was going home the next day. I went up to Harlem, I filled balloons full of heroin, I swallowed them, I never felt they could break in my stomach. All I thought about was going back to be behind bars because I wasn't escaping, and about getting high again. When I came in, they said to me, why'd you come like this? You're supposed to go home tomorrow. I said, I can't go out there. It was too frightening. Finally, I had to do more time, and finally when I got out, I had no friends now. I was living in senior and occupancy hotels, and after my rent was up for a week, they would never rent to me again. Anyway, a friend had come back, and she said if I wanted to hang out with her, I couldn't be stoned, sloppy kind of stoned, which for me meant no hard liquor and no barbiturates. So I started to drink beer, and I smoked pot, and I took speed, and I did NyQuil, and I did spray paint, and, you know, whatever else. And that's what I did. And what happened was I was awake a lot now because in the last 12 years of the drinking, I was mostly in blackouts. So I was not so sloppy now. And what happened is I didn't know how to cope being awake. And I started to eat to push those feelings down. Anyway, my mother was talking to me again because I wasn't sloppy. She had gotten an eviction notice because I used to crawl around in her lobby. And speaking about crawling around, you know, I say that I never got with a DWI, but I got a walking while intoxicated, and I got a sleeping in the puddle under the park bench while intoxicated in Los Angeles, but I never did that. But I was always very crawly. And so she was talking to me again, and she said, she saw that I had gained some weight and that I was upset, and she said, well, I heard about this program, Overeaters Anonymous. She said, why don't you come? I'll take you. She said, you could lose some weight. I said, okay. So we went to OA. It was the first time in a very long time that people talked to me, they hugged me, they told me to come back, they asked me to go out to coffee with them. It was what I had been looking for, people to like me. I kept going to OA. I really didn't work the steps or do too much there. I would come in and quote the big book as if I were a student, but I never lived it. And believe me, there's a big difference between knowing the written word and living the written word. The problem... the problem with OA was they kept telling me to go to AA. I come to meetings high, and I said, I'm not an alcoholic. God works in mysterious ways. One day I got very sick, and I couldn't get to an OA meeting. And someone from the Mustard Seed group in New York had given me a card. And the Mustard Seed was a couple of blocks from my house. I said, well, I'll go to this meeting. They told me any meeting is fine. I go to the Mustard Seed. It was a round robin. Came my turn. I said my name. I wasn't an alcoholic. You all laughed. He said, come back.
The program's great. You can lie and they tell you to come back. You can drink and they tell you to come back. You can smell and they tell you to come back. They told me to come back. And when I look back on it, it was the love in the rooms that got me. What I had always been searching for in the bottle was in the rooms. And all I wanted to do was go to meetings. Now, it's not that way for everybody. It was that way for me. I also had nowhere else to go. I remember that I had to tell people that I had no money. Could they feed me? And they would take me out for breakfast, and then they would take me to a lunch meeting, and then they would take me out for lunch, and then they would take me out for dinner and another meeting. And God, all I did was eat and go to meetings and go home and go to sleep. I didn't have time to drink. And I remember having to go to the Bowery and buy a winter coat that first year that I was sober. And I think that really has helped me in my growth. And this lady told me she was going to be my sponsor. She was one of those from the Mendel AAs. And it was Big Book and Steps. It was picking up the chairs and putting away the ashtrays. It was thanking the speaker even if you didn't like what the speaker said. It was going to at least one step meeting every week. It was reading the Big Book. And I remember when I first read it, it went in one eyeball and out the other. But I had accomplished something. She said to me, you're going to make 3 phone calls every day. And I'd call up and say, you're my first phone call, and I hang up. The people at the other end of the phone understood. Yeah. That's what this program is about, understanding. She told me I had to raise my hand at every meeting, and I would do it as soon as the speaker finished so I could get it over with. I'd be so nervous. She told me I was going to pray. Oh, that was horrible. The word God kept getting stuck, and today I have a relationship with God because I was willing to take the action. This is a program about action. And I began to do the steps and make my amends and look at my defects. And I thank God that He gave Bill Wilson the inspiration for the 10th step, because God knows I need to take personal inventory, and I just like to tell him myself a little bit. I was going back to school and I needed some student loans, so I called up the New York State Higher Education Corp to get some loans, and they said, oh, we've been looking for you since 1971. Seems in some blackout I took out a loan. They said, you have to pay the loan before you can get new ones. I said, I can't pay it. They said, why? I said, I'm on disability. They said, what's wrong with you? I said, I'm schizophrenic. And those words came out as if they were true. I wound up borrowing the money and paying the loan. Or the time I went to the library when I was in school, and now at least I took out the books. You know, I check them out, but you can't take out the journals. You got to Xerox them. So I Xeroxed a lot of journals. I had one left. It was a big one. I said, oh, hell, I'm taking it with me. I'm bringing it back. At least I was going to bring it back. So I walked through the gates in the library, and I started beeping. The librarian said, did you take any books out? I said, yes. She said, well, maybe they're not desensitized. I said, okay. She said, take them out. She said, I can't help you now. You got to wait. And God gave me a reprieve. I went to the Xerox machine and Xeroxed the journals. And the thing is that I will get up here and tell you, I go to meetings, I sponsor people, I have a sponsor, I work the steps, but the fact was that I was beeping with 9 years of sobriety. We have to be over-vigilant. The other one I love is that I was in the city and I needed to make a phone call and go to one of the public phones, and this guy was talking. And, you know, I always know my stuff is much more important. He's talking, and I'm giving him one of those looks, and he says to me, I'm going to be on for a while, and I look at him. And I want to do stuff for program, you know? It wasn't even personal stuff. And I look at him and I say, it's pricks like you that are in the city. It is amazing how I can behave as if I've never been to a meeting. And God knows I can talk to you about steps in Big Book, and I can live it and look it, but sometimes I forget. And I get into the feeling and get into the self-centeredness. And that's what happened. And I think for me, the greatest thing is the 12th step. Having a spiritual awakening, working the principles, helping others. Because it was in service that I got my dignity back. And that I had a purpose. Yeah. It is such a good feeling to be there for someone, and it's such a good feeling to let someone be there for me. I could never do that. I was a very, very tough
street drinking radio, and I could not let you in, and I could not tell you about my fears and my sadness. But because of the people, I was able to turn into a kind and gentle and soft woman, and that is a miracle. In closing, I'd like to tell you a favorite story. The red light's blinking. I, of course, want to talk for about 2 hours, but it's out of my control. There are these autistic-year-old kids. They're doing psychological testing on the kids because one kid very, very, very miserable and the other kid's always very, very happy. So they put the miserable kid in the room with a one-way mirror and every kind of toy you can think of. Think that he has Nintendo and electric cars and paints and game boards and computer stuff and stuffed animals. And he's sitting there with his arms folded and he won't touch a toy. You know that I'll show you look that we do to other people? And they put the very, very happy kid in the room with a one-way mirror with a pile of horse manure. And the kid's fooling in the mirror around. And the psychologist goes back to the room with the miserable kid and looks through the mirror, and the kid's sitting there doing with the long look and the arms folded, and he won't touch a thing. And the psychologist goes back to the room with the happy kid, and the happy kid's fooling in the mirror. And goes back to the room with the miserable kid, and the miserable kid still has not touched the toy, and his arms are folded, and he's going to be miserable. And the psychologist goes back to the room with the happy kid, he's still feeling the mirror. And the happy kid can't stand it. I mean, the psychologist can't stand it. And he goes into the room with the happy kid, and says, "What are you doing here?" And the happy kid says, "There's got to be a pain in here somewhere." And if you unfold your arms to the fellowship of our own and the steps of our own, you will find poems beyond your wildest imagination. And no one can make you unfold your arms but yourself. I have herds of poems. Bill Wilson said in the big book that he was catapulted into what he liked to call the fourth dimension of existence. That has happened to me. I'm in the fourth dimension of existence, and it is to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. And I thank you for my sobriety, I thank you for my life, I thank you for my dignity. God bless you.